Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today we will continue our relatively unique format as I transition back to host after taking some paternity leave, jumping right into some relatively lengthy interviews. I will be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, Layla Zaden, the COO of the Millennial Action Project, and Stephen Bourne, an engineer, political junkie, and newly published author. After the break, I will be joined by Layla and Bob, and we will be continuing in part the conversation we had last week on Facing the Future concerning millennial perspectives on key issues. Layla will provide some of the insights she shared during a recent panel with the Brookings Institution and share her experiences working with members of Congress and millennials in her role with MAP. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Layla Zaden and Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. Bob, you know well, he's a regular contributor and happened to be the interim host for a couple weeks while I was out. But Layla is the COO of the Millennial Action Project, or MAP. She was previously Managing Director for Generation Progress, where she led integrated communications, policy, and advocacy efforts around solutions to the challenges facing today's youth. She has spearheaded campaigns such as It's On Us and Higher Ed, Not Debt. In 2016, she was named by Fusion as one of 30 women under 30 who will change the election. She's regularly featured in national media outlets, and we're happy to have her on the show today. Welcome to Facing the Future, Layla, and welcome back, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you both for having me. Looking forward to chatting today.
Well, it's a pleasure having you on the show, and this is, in a sense, picking up off of something we discussed recently with Stuart Butler and Tim Higashi from Brookings, and it's a panel discussion that you participated in and Millennial Action Project actually co-sponsored about how millennials have what their perspectives are concerning climate change and the national debt. So before we dive headlong into getting into research and policy issues, can you give a little overview of what that panel was like for you? Were you happy with this results? What were your goals going into it?
Sure. Yeah, I thought it was an absolutely fantastic and rich conversation. Honestly, we could have sat there and talked for two more hours. I'm sure you guys feel similarly once you get going on these topics. There's so much to dissect and to dig into. But I was first and foremost just excited that the folks at Brookings were interested in even having a conversation around this topic, around how do we get young people more engaged on the issue of national debt and climate change, these long-term, seemingly intractable issues that require a trade-off today to solve tomorrow, right? So paying today for some outcome that is beneficial to our generation down the road. And I think that between all the different panelists and myself, we had a pretty good spectrum of experiences and perspectives around not just the communications efforts around that, but also what does the policy need to look like to engage this generation and to create real change.
So Layla, talking about the other panelists, were there any universal takeaways where everyone just had a unanimous consensus on certain issues or certain approaches when it comes to climate change and addressing it, the national debt and addressing it?
Yeah, I would say that what we all came away agreeing on is that those two issues, while structurally pretty similar, kind of these big asteroids headed towards this generation that are going to be big problems down the road, that actually this generation has had pretty opposite reactions to both of them. And we're seeing people taking to the streets and skipping school and demanding our elected officials be held accountable on the topic of climate change. But we're not seeing that same kind of advocacy and urgency around the issue of national debt. And so the conversation we had was quite interesting because on its face, these seem pretty similar in terms of types of problems, but yet the reaction and the response from this generation has been quite different.
What would you attribute the difference in response to? Is there a specific experience or lack of experience that, say, millennials have had relative to prior generations to prompt the responses you're seeing?
Mm-hmm. You know, I'd say that I think we as a generation understand that both issues are really important. Certainly with climate change, I've been talking about it for a long time, but even on the national debt, I think that millennials have a lot of personal experience with debt. You know, you talk about student debt or credit card debt. You know, we're educated on the importance of it, but it doesn't feel urgent the way that climate change does. We can see it with storms and natural disasters. We can see it in environmental injustice across the country. We can feel it every day. And I think that creates not just the importance, but the urgency around taking action on something that, you know, that you can turn on the TV and even the Weather Channel now, which is not a political policy focused, you know, station, is talking about kind of the impacts of man on climate change. And so I think what we need to do, or a lesson learned from the experiences advocating and creating momentum around climate, is to take those lessons and apply them to the national debt.
Layla, you mentioned something, a phrase that caught my attention. It was basically going through pain today for a benefit tomorrow. And millennials seem pretty willing to adapt that mindset when it comes to things like climate change that perhaps are a little more tangible, a little more personal, mm-hmm. for some of the reasons you just mentioned. Is it possible to get them to have the same perspective for issues relative to fiscal policy and the national debt? Or do you think it's so amorphous, so large, so hard to digest that there's really no hope in getting there?
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, the national debt feels so abstract and so amorphous, as you say. But truly, so does climate change, right? I mean, the Paris Accords is about getting the entire world on the same page about solving an issue. And if something's not bigger than that, then, you know, that's incredibly large and abstract and amorphous. I think, though, the difference is that there are really, really specific solutions being proposed in terms of what to do about climate that people can put their hands on and feels a lot more tangible in terms of solutions. And I think that's an important key to getting young people and millennials and Gen Z involved in advocating for solutions, is you have to draw that bright line between what they're doing today and how that's going to solve their problems. I think in the face of a lot of negative current realities, this generation is still an extremely optimistic bunch. And so we want to find solutions. I was actually reading in a Pew research study, and Pew actually participated in the conversation with Brookings that you referenced. But a study by Pew said that even though about 3/4 of millennials said they were not earning enough money to lead the lifestyle they wanted right now, almost 90% believe that they would earn enough in the future. That's wow. That's incredible optimism. Yeah. About 90% said that they would get to
optimistic.
Where they want to be. And I think that speaks to kind of this inherent generational ability to be optimistic, to see solutions, and a willingness to try, try new innovative tactics to get there. And so what we need to do is, you know, on the national debt, make it feel real. What are the actual solutions? What are the specific asks that we're asking people to mobilize around? We have to make it real in a way that I think it feels too big and too abstract right now, to the point where people are kind of throwing their hands up in the air and feeling almost fatalistic or nihilistic about it. You know, I think people joke about Social Security not existing and future realities. I think we're just not giving people the avenues to say, here's how we can stop that, or here's how we can fix it.
And Layla, you mentioned several things that I'm now wondering, for millennials, does our perspective generally cut across party lines? So who within our generation wants to address climate change? Is it very party affiliated, or is there now a growing feeling of a collective, like we should be doing something, thus we are all wanting to act on it, relative to other issues like healthcare reform or Social Security that, especially with generations ahead of us, are incredibly divided on political party lines. And I don't know that we're seeing that differentiate with millennials yet, but I am curious, in your work with us and with MAP, are you seeing any kind of difference in how millennials view these massive challenges? Are we drifting away from party affiliation on them, or are we staying pretty entrenched?
Yeah, I think that's a super, super smart observation, and is actually the entire founding principle upon which MAP was founded. So MAP's mission is to transcend political polarization by activating our nation's youngest leaders, not along party lines, but along generation lines. And I think because we recognize this point that you bring up, this innate ability within the generation to approach problem solving really differently. You know, we don't take a one-size-fits-all approach. As you may know, the fastest growing political affiliation right now is not Democrat, it's not Republican, it's actually independent or no affiliation. So millennials are not subscribing to the idea that one specific ideology has all the answers. And so MAP recognized an opportunity to build a cohort of people and of leaders who are united not around ideology, but along generational lines and around future-focused issues. And that's kind of how we talk about future-focused. And climate is actually, you know, one of those issues that we're seeing tremendous support from both Republicans and Democrats who are part of our future caucus. So, you know, those young leaders who we work with in Congress and state legislatures who are millennial aged. And I think we're having some really innovative conversations where when you're able to kind of shake loose that baggage of party affiliation and all of the assumptions that you make with what that person believes, you can start to disentangle the message from the messenger. And start to focus specifically on the issue. And I think climate is a great example of where focusing on that specific issue and the threat that it poses to our future generations has really enabled people from both parties or with no party affiliation to come together and find common ground.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Layla Zaden, COO of the Millennial Action Project, and we're discussing her role in a recent panel discussion on how millennials think differently about climate change and the national debt, as well as her work generally with MAP. And Bob, I know you want to jump in with a question, so I'm going to pivot right to you.
Well, I had a question about, because Layla had mentioned the Congressional Future Caucus, and also that you're doing similar things in the states. And I wonder if you could expound a little bit about that, because it seems like it's a really good idea to have, you know, legislatures both at the state and national level look at future issues like this. Mm-hmm. How did that come about, and is there any sort of coordination between the state, the emerging state leaders, you might say, and the Congressional Future Caucus here in Washington?
Yeah, so great question. And we launched the Congressional Future Caucus back in 2013 off the heels of the government shutdown, when it seemed like we had become the most polarized, you know, that it was the worst it could possibly get back in 2013. And so we launched this caucus with, you know, the idea that I just talked about, uniting young people and these young emerging leaders around a generational identity. And we quickly discovered that there was this huge opportunity in the States to do the same. And where we thought about building a leadership pipeline, well, why not build that pipeline even deeper before people are entrenched in their political careers and have the muscle memory of possible bad behavior? Let's start to create these networks and create these opportunities for people to work together as early on as possible and start to build those good habits at the very, very beginning of their careers. And so the Congressional Future Caucus right now has about 38 members, active members, and we are currently in 29 different states. And a lot of those states, you know, focus on what is most important to their unique kind of makeup and their unique challenges. But one of the big issues that we see is this topic of kind of energy and the environment and what to do with it. And we see, you know, both at the federal and the state level, an overwhelming desire to not pass the buck and not kick the can down the road, but really do something now. You know, enough is enough, and it's time to take action before the problem gets any worse.
And do they get involved in fiscal issues at all?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit easier to kind of answer that question at the congressional level because there's only one budget to talk about versus at the state level. There certainly are folks on the relevant kind of committees and working on kind of state budgets. At the congressional level, I think certainly, you know, these fiscal issues are incredibly important and things that our caucus wants to focus on. I think one of the issues is that, and this is probably something that you run into, one of the issues is that there are so many things that feel urgent, both urgent and important. And so with a limited amount of time and a limited amount of kind of bandwidth to focus on solving some of these big issues, you know, sometimes you can't go for the big, bold solutions, but you have to put that on hold or, you know, maybe focus on kind of a smaller piece of the problem before you can chew off the whole thing.
There are a lot of things that people feel passionately, even if they feel passionately about fiscal discipline, there are other things that they'll say, well, but this is really important. So some deficit spending in this regard is an investment and that's justified. And unless you're looking across a broad range of issues and saying how do these all add up together? Maybe we do want to spend more here, or maybe we do want to lower our tax there. But what do you do to make sure that the whole range of things comes out to be fiscally responsible? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that is a difficult task for members of Congress because they mm-hmm. do kind of silo things based on their individual interest and the states where they come from.
Right. Right. And I think one of the things that we're hoping to do is create a governing environment in which it's okay for people to be in their silos, but there's more trust across silos so that you feel like somebody who is working on, you know, say an infrastructure issue can be trusted to create something that fits into kind of this fiscally responsible vision while you work on maybe a tax issue. And by dividing and conquering in that way with colleagues who you trust and who are working towards kind of the same outcome, you can then start to create this future and create this solution that feels more cohesive and feels more sustainable and long-term.
And Layla, you mentioned a few things in the panel discussion that I think are worth bringing up here at this point in the conversation that really stood out to me. One of them was that you said there was a crisis of trust between really each side of an issue and also with policymakers. And you mentioned in this conversation that you want to help elected leaders develop good habits early on in their political careers. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that's one of the main reasons the Congressional Futures Caucus exists. But how do we help repair and rebuild that trust so that we can make progress on these issues?
First and foremost, I think you need to get to know somebody. And it might sound simple, but it's so easy to build a caricature of somebody if you've never spoken with them or haven't gotten to know what they stand for and who they are. And when you're operating from a place of stereotypes or assumptions, you're going to make the wrong call, and you're going to, you're operating without complete information, and so you're going to miss things. I think what we're trying to do is create those moments to build those relationships so that you can learn more about what makes somebody tick and what their individual positions are and where some of those positions might overlap with your own. And the more you start to build those networks and build those relationships, the more you can turn to them if you want a partner on a specific piece of legislation. And then the second step is just the repetition. What we do is really try to create the opportunities for these members to exercise that muscle, to continue to work with one another and to remember that they have an ally and a partner in their fellow Future Caucus members, so that as they advance in their careers, they have a longstanding history with whoever it may be, and they know that this is somebody who has been through it with them, who they can trust, and who they can turn to help solve the big problems.
I'm just curious, how do you do the recruiting at the state level? I mean, Congress seems like fairly easy. They're a captive audience, but with so many states, I'm just curious how you attract those members.
What we do at the state level is identify at least two leaders, sometimes four, one or two from each party, and name them as co-chairs of the State Future Caucus. And then we really lean on them to do the peer-to-peer outreach to help build out the caucus. We have a great team here at MAP that works closely with those state caucuses specifically. And then we just build programming based on that state's agenda and that state's specific set of needs and issues, while again, kind of empowering our co-chairs to really take the lead in setting that agenda and mobilizing their own peers. But, you know, I would say both at the congressional level and the state level, this peer-to-peer outreach is, certainly the most successful form of recruitment that we've used. And I think it works on the grassroots level too. You know, I talked about how I used to be an organization that did grassroots mobilizing. Nothing can replace the power of having a friend give you a recommendation or tell you, I trust this person or this is a good idea. I think that is, the most valuable asset that we have are our people.
And Leila, unfortunately, we're running short on time. I did have one more question I really wanted to get in, and this gets to an analogy that you made during the panel. You also drove home mm-hmm. that a big issue is how we frame the communication on these issues. And during that panel, you talked a bit about that, about framing. I'm going to paraphrase, mm-hmm. totally botch it, and give you a chance to correct it and make it better. You've talked about framing the conversation and the moving from the how to the what, and you gave a cable TV versus streaming online analogy. Can you break that down a little bit, maybe explain it a bit for our listeners?
You know, I think traditionally how we have thought about communicating messages is by using the party infrastructure to kind of package information in a way that is easily digestible to a massive audience. So the Democratic platform and the Republican platform were your two options, and you could pick one or you could pick the other or you could get lost. And I think what we need to recognize today is that young people, millennials, Gen Z, future generations, are not subscribing to a package deal this way. It's not a one-size-fits-all model for engaging on issues that you care about. You could both care very deeply about the national debt and care very deeply about climate change. And that's not necessarily something that you see prioritized in either party. And so you see this kind of analogy that I made, where young people today don't subscribe to full cable packages. I think actually at the event, I had people raise their hands if they had cable, and it was not a single millennial raised their hand.
I haven't had cable since I lived with my parents.
And it's because, you know, there's a ton of channels and there's a ton of things that you don't want to pay for because it doesn't speak to you and you're not going to use it. And it's frankly not something you're interested in, or maybe you actually actively dislike. And so instead, what we're seeing is people choosing their you know, streaming services more a la carte. You'll get Netflix or you'll get Hulu because there are specific shows that you want to watch, and kind of abandoning that cable model. And as we think about framing in a policy, in a political sense, I think that's an important analogy to keep in mind, that we can't be communicating a cable package to a streaming generation. And we need to be more nuanced and more targeted and more individualized about, you know, how and why we're talking about these really important issues.
This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Layla Zaidan, COO of the Millennial Action Project and Concord Coalition's Executive Director Bob Bixby. We discussed Layla's role in a recent panel discussion on how millennials think differently about climate change and the national debt. It was hosted by Brookings and the Millennial Action Project. Thank you for joining the show, Layla and Bob.
Thanks, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages with Stephen Bourne, who just published a new book called Consuming Government, concerning his ideas on how to better manage government services. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined in the show by Stephen Bourne. Stephen is an engineer with degrees from the University of New Hampshire and Northeastern University. He has strong ties to the community, from coaching his kids in youth sports to participating in Leadership New Hampshire. He even dabbled in politics, attempting to start an independent party back in the early 2000s, and he's gotten involved with organizations like No Labels and the New Hampshire Rebellion. In many ways, these experiences have inspired his new book, Consuming Government, which takes a closer look at finding ways for us to better manage the government services we buy. Welcome to Facing the Future, Stephen.
Thank you, Chase.
So I just gave a very brief synopsis as to where we're going in today's conversation. Can you give a high-level view of your book for our listeners and maybe what inspired it?
So the inspiration was, like, as you mentioned, I've been involved in a lot of things over the years. And I, as an engineer, I'm attracted to what's broken. And I finally realized that I've got to focus on the people. And the book was to take a lot of my ideas and then direct them, how do we get people motivated to actually choose to spend the time to manage all the government services we buy? And that's where the title comes in, Consuming Government, to reframe the question. Instead of, you know, having government be them or what they're doing or something they were powerless to do anything about, to approach it as a consumer, and as a consumer to be responsible for our money that we spend. And so the book is actually, you know, lays out how we got into this problem. I think it's important to do that level set. And then it uses a flywheel analogy for a couple reasons. The first is that you talk to anyone saying, you know, we've got to change this, we've got to do something. You hear all the time, you can't fight City Hall, it's too big, it's too entrenched, I'm just one person. And they're right. But if you think of it as a big, huge stone flywheel, that one person isn't going to do much. But if a whole bunch of people do a little bit and start pushing at that flywheel, at first it's not going to feel like we're doing anything. You know, we don't even have to be moving in the same direction, as long as we're all doing something to slow it down a little bit. Eventually, we can turn this around and getting the democracy working more effectively for us. And so that is, you know, one obstacle we need to get around. The second one is just to take that flywheel. And the way the book is structured is it's all about the economy. We can't, you know, let's not kid ourselves. If the economy's not cruising, nothing else is happening. And so it breaks up the book into four sections about, you know, to create a vernacular, how we can talk about things. There are things that are brakes that suck energy out of that economic flywheel.
There are things that are weights that we have to fight through in every single revolution. And then there are things like the Do Nothing Congress that, you know, we're paying a lot of money and they don't get anything accomplished. It's like sand on the axle. But then when we do things like I'm involved in with the Rise Civic League, we're putting, you know, we're putting our time and effort to help people better manage our government. That's grease on the axle. And that's how the book's structured in those sections.
So, Stephen, you mentioned in the outset, you know, throwing out there that the title that you're wanting to motivate people to help better manage government services. And you use the flywheel analogy as the structure of the book itself. But before we get into more detail and those different elements of the flywheel, what are the government services that you had in mind that you were writing about that you're hoping either can become more efficient or people can have more control over or what have you?
Well, so we're going to have to start locally. We'd love to tackle the biggest waste is probably at the federal level or the big, you know, we're probably, you know, we obviously spend the most in federal government, but we've got to go back to what I call common denominator government. So take the person on the farthest left, the farthest on the farthest right, and that live in the same community. There's some level of local government they both agree that we need to have. Start there and learn to work together, asking the questions. Are we getting value? How do we measure that value? If we're paying more, how do we know we're getting more? There's no reason in the world we can't have the most cost-effective and efficient government in the world, but we need to choose to drive it to be like that.
And Stephen, are you hoping, are you viewing a more high-level involvement in local government and the local process as a stimulus for, you know, getting involved at the state and federal level, or do you see that level of involvement changing as you go through the different tiers of our system? Like, how does this all play out?
So, everything's all theoretically, and there is no one panacea for everything. But ideally, if we start working at the local level and start rebuilding those skills, and I have ideas in there such as civic days and things like that, that we build up the skills, how to talk, listen, work together locally. And as we develop those skills to start to move it up the ladder to counties, eventually states, and, you know, and then the federal government, I'm hoping that if we are starting to do this, you know, at a larger scale locally and then the county level, the larger branches of government will won't be writing on the wall, but we see this big wave coming towards them. And you know, they'll start adjusting because they know it's coming in that direction.
And so is the ultimate goal, I guess, of the book to get people more involved or more informed or some combination of the two?
It's some combination of the two. It's, you know, like I said, we have to fix the people, and the situation, you know, would be, and, you know, and not sure how long it will take, but in a generation or so, that everyone's going to view that their civic responsibility is something that we all do. We all choose to spend some of our time, you know, every year. You could have some sabbaticals and you have a child or something, but we all know that we've got to contribute in some way to making sure that we are getting better value for our government year over year. And once it gets going, you know, some people could be focused on the federal government, other on the state, other on county or local. But if we're all doing a little bit, we'll have the information to make better decisions, to manage the people that we're hiring, and there'll be a greater level of efficiencies. Because, like I said early on, if we have the most efficient government services, we're getting the most for what we're spending. You know, in a global economy, that could be a competitive advantage. It can really power our economy for decades.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Stephen Bourne. We're discussing his new book, Consuming Government. And picking back up on the book itself, Stephen, you mentioned that it's broken down into the elements of a flywheel. You kind of gave some high watermarks of what each element does or could do. Take us through the book. Not necessarily chapter by chapter, but what are the primary takeaways you would want the reader to have when they read the section on, you know, the brakes or the weights or the sand in the axle and et cetera?
Yeah, no, appreciate it. So, you know, the first section of the book actually talks about, you know, what, you know, how do we get into this situation? And I think most of us believe in the democratic equation that our founding fathers established, but we also would agree that it's probably not working. And so what happened? And I go into something called, if you ever, people ever solve differential equations, it's how you solve nonlinear problems. But for the math to work, you have to establish boundary conditions. And those boundary conditions that allowed that democratic equation to work have gone away. They were things like discussion and debate, having a press that actually informed and educated people, the way we could put information up, putting a flyer on the oak tree and getting those ideas out, or printing a pamphlet and people saw that. So the world has radically changed since, you know, in the last 250 years. But those boundary conditions that we worked, you know, we have to come up with new ways of doing that. So then if we go back into the segments of the book, so the best example of a break would be the broken business of medicine. So if you just picture that spinning flywheel and a metal bar pushing against that flywheel, it's turning and just, you know, sparks coming out of it. We pour so much money into healthcare because the business of medicine is broken that it's just pulling out energy or out of our economy. Anything that we do to start better fixing the broken business of medicine, that starts to pull back on that break. So even if it's local, little things, asking questions, being a better informed consumer, going to the doctor, figuring, all right, how much is it going to cost? You know, am I going to have to spend 2 hours doing it? Why are you having me drive, you know, all this distance, which is a waste of my time, but I could be doing this in maybe another hospital program that's local. You know, anything like that pulls back on the brakes. And so there were a lot of things that act like brakes. You know, crime is another one that just sucks energy. Think of everything we pay for police, judicial, never mind the victims. And so there's a number of things like that. Weights, obviously the most easiest one to understand is the national debt. So picture a big, huge, you know, bucket with lots and lots of stones in it or something, you know, grabbing onto the backside of that flywheel. Every single revolution of that economic flywheel, we have to fight through that weight. And if you think of what happened in Greece, was their debt and everything got so big, they didn't have the economic energy to fight through the weight of that debt. So anything that we do that reduces the debt, or other things that we do that are, you know, very inefficient with how we allocate our money, makes that weight smaller and allows more energy to stay in our flywheel. The sand in the axle is, you know, all the money in politics, how the system doesn't really work for the people. It's working for those that are donating the money. How we manage and elect people are all things that are sand in the axle, you know, gerrymandering, et cetera, and what we could be doing locally to remove that sand from the axle. And then the grease on the axle, you know, the best example that we talk about is the things we've been doing on the Rise Civic League, like the monthly email that just educates people. What are the top things that happen at the select board, at planning, at zoning? You know, we're all busy. We don't have a lot of time. And so the Civic News puts things in short, digestible things that help people know what's going on in town. And there are a lot of things that the Civic League does that can be repeated in other communities.
I want to go back to a few of the things you just mentioned there, Stephen, and going back to the break. You mentioned the broken, what you called the broken business of medicine. It, you know, it's no secret that we spend, I think it's trillions of dollars on healthcare at this point in our nation. It's a huge burden on individuals. It's a massive portion of the federal budget. Do you suggest specific reforms within the system or a system-wide change? Like right now, it's a presidential election year. We're in New Hampshire. A lot of candidates coming through with different ideas. So does the book ascribe to any specific set of policy ideas, or are you suggesting tweaks within the system itself?
So actually, it is the broken business medicine is probably the only one is the the one instance where I really say, hey, here's my ideas that I think we should be pushing forward. And what I say to fix the broken business of medicine is that we have to do a couple things, actually three things. One is, you know, our society has to face the fact that we are not going to let people die at the hospital doorstep. I used to say die in the streets, but my sister takes care of homeless and AIDS patients in San Francisco and corrects me and say, yes, we do let people, lots of people die in the streets. So, you know, people, our culture is not going to have hospitals turning people away. So that is going to be some sort of shared cost model where we're all going to have to kick in and have that be covered. The rest of it needs to be broken up into two pieces. We have to start talking about wellness, and that's staying healthy. So that is, you know, and the people and the doctors being measured on how good of a job are you at staying healthy and being healthy, doing what the doctor said, taking the medicine, being responsible for the cost and quality of your care. And so that will be wellness. Insurance needs to go back to being just insurance. So, you know, if you're, you know, the best analogy is with a car. Your insurance, you know, people use this a lot, doesn't put gas or in your car or buy you new tires. You're responsible for that. Your insurance is when something happens out of your control. And insurance needs to go back to being something outside your wellness. And that, and it, and not the the overall power determining what we do and not do with our all of our medical care. So that's, I subscribe that we, you know, break the business of medicine into those three parts. And by having the focus and the more of the individual's responsibility on the wellness, will get us in the direction of fixing the broken business of medicine.
When you're talking about weights, you mentioned the national debt. I work for the Concord Coalition, so the national debt is a big issue for us. And you say it's one of those things that is diverting energy away from the rotation of the flywheel, and controlling our national debt can help, you know, re-energize or allow that energy to go back into each revolution of the flywheel. So in making a statement like that or a suggestion like that, are you putting out an idea or proposal on a specific amount of debt or a percentage of debt to GDP? How do you approach that issue?
No, it's just that, you know, I think anyone that's realistic about reducing the debt knows that we can't cut our way out of this, and we can't spend our way out of this. It's got to be a combination of both. And that by, if we focus on, you know, because what we buy in government services is the biggest corporation in the world. And by getting that corporation to run more efficiently, is how we'll help reduce the debt. Because if we're that productivity gains and efficiencies is what will create the economic energy that will allow us to pay down the debt.
And last question before we have to go here, I want to take a bigger view of the book itself and the concept of the flywheel. You know, how do your, in your mind, how do your proposals or your suggested reforms differ from other past proposals or perhaps recent books on similar issues? Do you think it falls in line with sort of, you know, modern thought on these things, or is it a more of a unique take that you think sort of goes against the grain of the thought of reform on a lot of these topics?
I would think a lot of it is going to be what people haven't seen before. You know, just some people ask me to describe myself, and some people say they think outside the box. I happen to live outside the box. So it's a different approach. So something that I'm working on right now is an idea from the book called Tavern Nights. And what we're working on, we actually have one set up in my town in January, is to create an atmosphere like a tavern, where where a safe place where people can actually go and it's okay to talk about politics. And we're going to do it civilly and respectfully. And, you know, you can have your opinions, but people aren't comfortable. They're scared of talking about politics. And we have to do that because the discussion, the debate are so important to force you to understand that you really know what's talking about, because if you can't explain something, you really don't understand it. And not everyone's got all the right ideas. And so, you know, things like that, if we can do that across the state, can change how we do things. And there are a lot of things in there that I guarantee you most people have never thought about before.
It definitely sounds like your focus on the book is to get people to act and to find common ground, which I think are really important steps that need to be taken in this very divided, both politically and ideologically, era. I appreciate you taking the time, Stephen. This is Facing the Future. We're talking to Stephen Bourne about his new book, Consuming Government. Thank you for joining the show.
Appreciate it, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.